The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
When I brought that letter to my career teacher and I told her I wanted to be a lawyer, she turned around and said in a cold and dismissive way, "You, a lawyer, at best, you're going to end up stacking shelves, but somebody like you is going to end up in prison." I mean, she was right about me ending up in prison. I only forgot to say that after having seen my clients, I can go home again.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to The Hearing Podcast. My name is Yasmin, and today my guest is Sean Wallace. Sean Wallace is a barrister, lecturer, and TV personality. He's most well known for his appearances on The Chase, a quiz show which has become a staple of British TV. My conversation with Sean was a lot of fun. We talked about his journey to becoming a barrister, how he got into the world of TV. I found Sean very resilient. He's got a really positive energy about him, incredibly upbeat, and I think listeners will find that he's got a message of hope. Not to see knockbacks as mistakes or failures, but actually to see them as opportunities to grow. And what really came through for me was Sean's love of learning. So sit back and enjoy this conversation.
The Hearing.
Welcome to the Hearing Podcast, Sean. Great to have your company. How are you this morning?
Finally, Yasmin. Lovely day. Did my usual stint in the park this morning because I train every single morning to keep myself fit and ready for the day.
Fantastic. How many miles do you do running or what?
Run anymore. I used to run a mile a day, but because I've got problems with my knees now, my doctor said I shouldn't run. So I just use the outdoor gym and I've got a rowing machine. So that's what I normally
Very
do.
Very good. Very dedicated. I like that. Fantastic. Well, let's get straight into it.
Okay.
Some people may know you. We've also got a US audience, so I'll be asking questions assuming some people don't know you.
Okay.
Because of our US audience. But you are a barrister. That's one of the things you do. And we'll get into your TV career as well. But Sean, could you take us back to those early days of your career? What initially drew you to the field of law?
What drew me to the field of law, Yasmin, way back when I was 11 years old, I used to watch programmes like Crown Court, Petrocelli, my favourite fictional hero, Rumpole the Bailey, by one of my favourite lawyers, John Mortimer Casey. So I used to be fascinated how people could use their skills in terms of representing people in court. And I wanted to do that. I didn't see why not, apart from the fact that you got to dress up in a wig and gown, I suppose.
Yeah. And did you have any influences growing up, or is it just what you saw on TV?
We all have influences. We all have role models. If you were to come to my house, I've got a wall called My Inspiration, which is a mural of all my heroes, ranging from Sojourner Truth to Harriet Tubman to Jesse Owens, Tommy Smith, who did the Black Power salute, Bob Marley, my favourite Muhammad Ali. And the reason why they're heroes is because they're black. They were black heroes who I looked up to because they had the same colour skin as me. And obviously living at a time in the 1960s where, racism was rife, it was good to see people who had the same colour skin as me making great strides on the world stage. And I used to say as a little kid, if I had a fraction of what they've achieved in my life, then my life's going to mean something.
That's interesting. And did you find that journey into law quite challenging, given the racism that was rife at the time?
Educational standards had a low expectation of people of colour or people from a lower socioeconomic background. If you're a young black girl, they expected you to be working in a typing pool or sadly living in a high-rise council flat with loads of children running around your ankles with no visible man to support you. If you're a young black boy, they expect you to either work as a bus mechanic working in a factory or sadly be engaged in a criminal justice system. In relation to the latter, you ask what's changed. But any dreams or aspirations of being a doctor, lawyer, or dentist were seen as a complete anathema. So when I was 12 years old, Yasmin, I wrote to the Bar Council, and when they wrote back to me, it was the very first letter I got, and I was so excited, and it told me what I needed to achieve in order to actually realise those dreams as a lawyer. And when you go through that rite of passage, when you do your exams, 50 to 60 years ago, there was a two-tier system of educational exams, the CSEs, the so-called vocational, which had a tendency to be done by people of my colour and background or sort of social lower economic background, and the O-levels, which had a tendency to be done by the people of a sort of higher social class. I mean, that sounds a bit sort of, you know, black and white, but that's how it really was. So when I brought that letter to my careers teacher and I told her I wanted to be a lawyer, she turned around and said in a cold and dismissive way, "You, a lawyer, at best, you're going to end up stacking shelves, but somebody like you is going to end up in prison." I mean, she was right about me ending up in prison. I only forgot to say that after having seen my clients, I can go home again.
Yeah.
But to be told that as a 15-year-old can be devastating. But as a young kid, I was determined that you know, the future's going to be in my hands. But the only way I could ensure that, Yasmin, was to ensure that I had an educated mind.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's not an isolated case. I hear this time and time again from people of colour saying what their teachers told them.
Yeah.
Were you quite academic at school then, Sean?
I was, but one of the reasons I wrote my autobiography called Chasing the Dream is because of the fact that when people see you on TV, they think I was born clever, they think I was born rich, they think I was born famous. Mm. But I wrote that book because I want people to realise that academically, I had my own setbacks. It took me 4 times to pass O-level English language. And 44 years ago, when all my friends were going off to university and my grades weren't high enough, I thought my world had crashed because for me, there was no plan B. It was a lawyer or nothing. But sometimes, you know, when you do have setbacks in life, it's always easy to point the finger of blame or suspicion. It was his fault. It was her fault. They didn't support me. But the one thing I always say to people is this. The first person you've got to look at is the reflection in the mirror. You've got to ask yourself those searching questions. And I did. And no man is an island. Okay, I was academically bright, but I didn't know how to pass exams. So obviously, I had the support of people who really did have my interests at heart. I changed my school to a school called Elstone High School in the Bronzeville area of London, and they were very, very supportive. And the penny dropped. I knew how to pass those exams. I got a 2-2 at the Polytechnic of North London, and 35 years later, they awarded me a doctorate.
Oh, congratulations.
So, I passed the bar finals at the first attempt in 1984, and this year I'm celebrating 40 years as a practicing barrister. So, you know, even starting off as a young barrister, it wasn't that easy. And I'm not saying I was overtly discriminated on grounds of my colour, because there are subtle forms which people can hold you back. There was a tendency, if you were a black practicing barrister, you do publicly funded work. I wanted to be a criminal lawyer anyway, so I didn't mind becoming a legal aid lawyer. But you know, trying to get into sort of commercial law or tax law was very, very difficult. But that didn't hold me back because at the end of the day, I'm a firm believer that talent and ability will always shine through irrespective of your colour. And that's why you're now seeing a more diverse bar than you're seeing 40 years ago. You're seeing much more black women coming into the profession, which is wonderful. You're seeing black more women KCs, which is fantastic. I've know a few friends of mine who are people of colour, and they've taken silk. So there has been that wonderful diversity, and the old school tie has basically gone up in smoke.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. What I'm also hearing, unfortunately, as well, is that still now, as you say, the sort of racism is more subtle and not as overt. It still happens.
It always will be subtle, because one thing about racism, Yasmin, if you call it out and you shine a light on it, it sort of regresses, becomes more nuanced, becomes more subtler. You know, that's the one thing is going to be very, very difficult to actually completely eradicate, because sadly, people do have inherent prejudices. It's part of our natural makeup. I wrote an article 2 years ago for a right-wing newspaper because they asked me to write about it in relation to the George Floyd situation. And one thing which gladdened me was that we saw all the protests around the world by young people, black people, young people, white people. These are the people who are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. And the one thing I finished off my article by saying was this. As long as they still have that sense of not being tainted by power, because power has a tendency to corrupt, and you know what I say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And as long as they still have that sense of fair play and justice, when they become leaders, maybe then they will see what it's like and seen firsthand the horror and injustices of racism. And when they become the leaders of tomorrow, hopefully they will be the people to finally eradicate it. But for now, as I say, you can't get rid of that sort of nuanced way in which subtle forms of racism evolves and becomes more and more subtle.
Yeah, I think it's like a virus. It mutates into something else, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I wonder, when you go to court, because I hear this from a lot of black barristers or people of colour, it's the way it takes its form now is the assumptions that perhaps the court staff make about why you're there in the courtroom, or, you know, they might assume you're the defendant or, you know, something else. I hear that a lot. Does that happen to you?
Well, the very first time I went to Bristol Crown Court, I remember I was in a nice suit, walked into court, and one of the court ushers came up to me and said, are you waiting for your barrister? Mm. And I looked at her. I said, no, I'm waiting for my client. And I wasn't offended in any way, shape or form, because I don't allow things like that to offend me, because the best way in which you can defeat attitudes like that is to display your professionalism.
Yes, absolutely. When they go low, we go higher.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hope your teacher who said that remark to you watched your performance in 2004 on Mastermind. Just our listeners may not know what Mastermind is for our US listeners. Can you just explain what Mastermind is?
It's probably the toughest television quiz show in Britain. It's like being interrogated by a Gestapo Nazi officer. A bright light shined on you. You're asked a specialist subject and you're asked a general knowledge subject. And in 2004, I became the first black person of colour to apply in the show's history. And I went on to become a Mastermind champion. So that obviously really catapulted me into the national consciousness, because I was doing quiz shows before. But, you know, to become the first black Mastermind champion, I was really well received by the establishment. When I say something, it was really, really wonderful. And it just goes to show that intelligence and talent is colourblind. And one of the remarks I made, which made the quote of the week on the Times, I said, me winning Mastermind was the equivalent of Neil Armstrong taking the first steps on the moon. But it shattered the myth that black people are only capable of being brilliant in art, dance, sport. No, we have the same intellectual capacity. We always have had.
Yeah, and remind
always
me.
Always will have.
Yes, remind me of your subject.
They were all on football subjects, because I'm a big football fan. No, I've never hidden that. I'm an ardent Chelsea fan, and I've been a fan since 1967.
Yeah, I watched that again, and it is very impressive. Did you get any answers wrong? I can't remember.
In the final, I did. I suppose what helped me win, apart from being dedicated to preparing, is I use my transferable skills as a barrister. The art of research, the art of thinking on your feet, the art of being fearless. I've used those transferable skills in a way which has helped me in this shark-infested world of entertainment. Yeah. So I am grateful to the training I've had as a barrister. The bar have always been proud of me. I've always been proud to represent it. But I always make this point, Yasmin, despite the fact that I'm well known in the public eye in the field of entertainment, I'm a lawyer who happens to be on TV, not the other way around.
Interesting distinction, yeah. So I want to get into your law career, and then I'd love to focus on your TV accomplishments as well.
Yeah.
Do you have a standout moment for you, a case that you would want to mention?
I suppose the very first trial I did in the Crown Court, and it was in 1988 in Knightsbridge Crown Court. It was my very first trial, and I was up against a very experienced prosecutor who knew I was inexperienced, but, you know, we got on very, very well, and he didn't take advantage of my experience, and it was a very good trial. But what the highlight of that was when the judge said my closing speech was excellent. For a young black kid, hearing that from an experienced judge, it made me 20 feet tall. It made me realise that I belong in this profession. I've always used that as the reason why I stayed in this profession, because it was a validation of all the hard work, of all the tears, all the frustration, of finally being able to represent a client and to be told by a judge that your closing speech was excellent was just one. And it helped me. It gave me the confidence to actually progress my career. It wasn't an easy progression. I always say to people, trying to climb the top of the greasy pole is very, very difficult, because if you don't know how to hang on inexorably, you'll find yourself sliding back down to the bottom of the pole. But, you know, people know how to actually, after you sort of go up down that pole a number of times, you know how to actually hold it. But the key is, when you get to the top, is staying there.
Yeah, that's harder, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool. But inside, there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'm really intrigued. How did you get into TV? How did that come about? That's quite a leap.
Because as a young boy, apart from my love of law, my love of learning, if I could show you the back of my autobiography, as you can see there, those are the three things which define me: my love of law, my love of football, and my love of learning. All those three things combined to help me become a mastermind champion. And as a young kid, I used to love watching the TV shows like University Challenge. I watched the very first Mastermind when it was on the graveyard shift in September 1972. And I was fascinated how people could put themselves through the rigmarole of sitting in a black chair, being asked questions by an intimidating question master, with a watching studio audience, with millions of people watching from the comfort of their sofa at home. And I thought that took courage. And I'm always encouraging people, Yasmin, to actually go on to quiz shows, because the worst thing you can do on a quiz show is get a question wrong. You know, never in a million years would I have thought, you know, sitting in the comfort of my sofa, that it would inexorably change my life. And that's why I always say to people, education is the key to controlling your own destiny. No information is useless information. Always remember that. Because somebody might ask you a question, you may be the only person who may know the answer, and it could change your life.
Oh, well, I'll remember that. So tell us about your book. I mean, you showed it to me, but we're going to put it in the show notes for our listeners.
It was a labour of love. I wrote it in the aftermath of me losing the Eggers Grand Final in 2008, because after winning Mastermind, I retired. Where could I go? They're not going to let me on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, because they know that I'd win £1 million without even using a lifeline. So I decided to retire. I was then begged by the BBC to come out of retirement because they were looking for a new egghead panellist. And Eggheads at the time was the quiz show to be on. I got to the grand final and I lost. And I was sitting in a BBC car park on the fifth floor listening to Steely Dan's hits, greatest hits, wondering how it is I managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. And when I was reflecting after I listened to Babylon Sisters, which is my favourite Steely Dan track of all time, I thought to myself, you know what? You haven't done too badly, Sean, and people would want to know your life story. Not the sort of quizzing world, or the quizzing success. They want to know the backstory, the heartache, the struggles, the tears, the disappointments, the setbacks. And I thought to myself, it's important for me to share that story because it will give people inspiration and hope to realise that if you do have setbacks in life, it doesn't mean to say that your future's behind you. I can count the setbacks I've had on more than three hands. But it's not deterred me from basically saying, listen, okay, God's given me one life and I want to make the most of any opportunity I do have. And if I do have setbacks, then you know what, guess what? I'm going to try and overcome them. Sometimes not by yourself, because no man's an island. And sometimes you've got good people, they will help you. But at the end of the day, you've got to want it yourself. Mm. You know the old adage, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make it drink. But you've got to want it.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the growth is, isn't it? The feedback, the failures. I don't see it as failure. It's learning better for next time.
Yeah, it's all about life's experiences. Okay, if you do have a setback, you have a setback. And sometimes it's disappointing. But don't let that setback control your life. Don't let that setback keep you in a life straitjacket. Because if you do, you won't progress.
Do you do any public speaking? Because you sound
all
like...
the time.
Yes, I can see this. Yes, I can imagine. Because I think a lot of school children and corporates would find this message.
I was doing that before I was famous. But for me, I'm blessed and very, very fortunate. I don't take it for granted because remember, I'm today's news, I'm tomorrow's shipwrecker. I always say that. You know, everything has a shelf life or sell-by date. But I've always thought that you should always use your fame in an altruistic way. The one thing about fame and riches and being successful, it's all well and good. But when you shuffle off this mortal coil, Yasmin, you can't take it with you. So it's important to try and leave a legacy. It's important to use your fame in an altruistic way to put that ladder of opportunity for others to climb up. Because one day, I need to pass that torch of responsibility onto the next person.
Mm. And talking about fame, Sean, how is it when you're going about in public? And what about your relationship with your clients? Does it get in the way?
No, it doesn't get in the way of my legal career. Because at the end of the day, Sean Wallace, the chaser, will not win trials because he's Sean Wallace, the chaser. Because the one thing that won't change is the evidence.
Yes.
You think I can magic a wand and basically say, oh, because Sean Wallace is here, so why? I'm going to change the evidence in my favour. No. I'm in a different arena when I'm a barrister.
Yeah.
Sean Wallace is a barrister because it doesn't give me an advantage, and nor should it.
Mm-hmm. But clients, in terms of recognising you, does it help that they probably have seen you on TV, that familiarity?
It does. And even before I was famous, that wasn't an advantage, because I was a busy practicing criminal barrister anyway.
Yeah. Well, let's get into The Chase because it has become a staple of British television.
Yeah.
So those who may not have seen The Chase, tell us, how does The Chase work? What's your role that you play in it, your involvement?
You've got four contestants who try to combine together to try and be a quiz professional like myself. They go through a cash builder round where they're asked quick fire questions in a minute, £1,000 for every correct answer. And what will then happen, whatever they get in that minute, for example, if they get six right, they get £6,000. They have a three-step head start to get back home to try and bank that money. Or they can take a lower offer, which is, for example, to try and get back. Or they can try and come closer to me while they've got a higher step. If they manage to get back, then they bank the money. And at the end, how many of the contestants get through will determine what head start they get. So, for example, if three get back, they'll get a three head start. They've got to answer as many questions as they can in 2 minutes. If I don't beat that total, they take the money home. If I do, they lose it. Yeah. So I'm the world's first chaser.
I didn't know that.
Because when I was approached by the ITV, because I retired again after winning, after losing the grand final, because I thought that's it. I've done my stint of quizzing, but I was then approached by ITV again to take part in what they considered to be an exciting new game show concept, and I was a bit sceptical. All right, okay, I went along to the audition. They asked me 30 questions. I got 28 out of 30. And they said to me, what are you doing quizzing-wise? I said, look, I've retired now. I said, oh, by the way, because they were then showing Are You an Egghead? The series I was in. They said to me, how did you do? I said, I'm not telling you. You want to see how good I am? You watch it. See ya. So when they showed me losing on December the 2nd, 2008, I then get a phone call the following day. Can I turn up to a pub on the Gray's Inn Road? Okay. Walked into the pub. I looked to my left. I see a team of ITV commissioners. I see to my right a team of budding contestants waiting to take on this chaser. So like a brilliant cricketer, the great Brian Lara, I swatted them, battered them off. Not a problem. And they were so impressed. They said, look, they need me to see me in some other settings as a chaser. So I did three more or commissions or auditions. They then said, right, you're doing, we want you to, you need a partner. So I said, all right. So I then had the Beast, Mark Labette. So we then had to go up to the Old Granada Studios, ironically, before my 49th birthday on June the 1st, 2009. And I was supposed to start a murder trial on that very day as a junior. So the client I was representing, I secured an acquittal for him and an attempted murder. So I approached him. I said, look, I need to do this pilot. I said, this trial lasted 6 weeks. You know, we'd be doing a preliminary hearing. So, you know, I'll be back. It gave me his blessing. I went to go and see my leader. I told him, I said, look, I need to do this pilot. He said, Sean, as long as you get somebody covering you, that's fine. So I've got somebody that covered me in Chambers. We went up there 15 years later. Here I am. Very, very fortunate to be in such an iconic quiz show. I feel like a member of the Beatles. Because everybody loves and knows a chaser. And if people stop me in the street, Yasmin, I'll always stop and take photographs and mingle with them because it's my way of saying thank you to them for making me famous.
Yeah, and you're one of six chasers, aren't you? And you're called, your character's the Dark Destroyer.
Correct.
Yeah, which I love.
Yeah, I'm called that because I'm dark, because I'm black. I destroy people because of my intellect.
And yeah, deadly combination.
Absolutely.
And that sort of lead, you were talking about how you balance, you know, TV work, a busy criminal practice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage your time between legal work and TV?
I've been a barrister for 40 years now. Obviously, I've got a very supportive set of chambers, so I can pick and choose the type of cases I want to do now.
Okay, so that's the secret. Yeah. And as a junior, you managed to talk to your seniors and get cover.
Yeah, because we've got very supportive chambers. However, if I've got a long trial, then that will take precedence over my filming, and the chase know that. But I've then got to make up my other episodes later on in the series.
I see.
So when people see me, not see me on TV for long, has he been sacked? No. That's my legal career.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. That's nice. Gone back to my career.
Yeah. Why do you think The Chase is so popular? I mean, what sets it apart from other quizzes?
I think you've got a wonderful host in Bradley Walsh. He's witty, funny, spontaneous with his ad-libs. And you've got six different characters in terms of the chasers, really. You've got the menacing beast, you know, who can be sort of intimidating. You've got a sort of schoolmastery, got a governess. You've got the sultry vixen. You've got the best chaser, in my opinion, out of lot, the Cinnamon. And you've got the wonderful new menace in terms of Dennis the Ennis Menace. So, you know, you've got six different characters and we all get on very, very well, which is important because when Mark came on board, I said to him, look, in order for this show to work, we've got to respect each other's opinions. You know, I'm not interested in if you're better than me as a quizzer. I'm not interested.
Mm.
We've got to work and respect each other.
Yeah.
And that's been the key ingredient, I suppose. And we, you know, from the people who get us a coffee to the sort of behind the scenes, we're all one big family. We all respect each other because we all know that if we want to put out a good product, it's got to be reflected in relation to respecting the people behind the scenes because people behind the scenes make the people in front of the cameras look good.
Absolutely, all playing a part. And how do you prepare intellectually and psychologically for the chase?
I revise every single day on my phone. So I've got, I go to YouTube, I just watch Mastermind, I watch 15 to 1, I watch, and just test myself. I'm not interested in what I already know. I'm interested in what I don't know. That's how I learn.
Mm.
I keep myself contemporary. You know, what's the latest number one song? Who's the latest prime minister? The latest events. That's how you keep yourself sharp.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a good lesson for life anyway, even if you're not entering a quiz show or being a contestant, is keeping your brain.
Yeah, exactly. Open. And never, ever take your talent for granted. I don't take the fact that I've won Mastermind and I'm a chaser. I don't think I can sit back and expect it to just work. You've got to constantly work at your craft.
Yeah.
Constantly.
And and looking ahead, Sean, what are your aspirations for your career? So both in law and TV, Do you see yourself balancing these two worlds?
Yeah. As you know, for me, it's about staying in control of my destiny. As long as the chase want me, I'll be available. As long as I still have got the appetite for law, I'll do it. It's all about staying in control of your own life.
And beyond TV and your career, are there any other aspects? Because you seem like someone who's a go-getter, you know, very driven. Are there any other aspirations?
The one thing I want to do after I shuffle off this mortal coil, I want my name to resonate in the ages for standing for altruism, for trying to inspiring people. That's what I want my name to be. Because I've said to you before, I can't take my fame with me when I shuffle off this mortal coil. I want to leave the name and the legacy behind.
Yeah. Where can people find you, Sean? Are you on social media? Or?
Yeah, I'm on social media all the time, TikTok, mainly Instagram. They can always contact my agents, celeb agents. They're wonderful. I'm accessible. If you want me, you can get me.
Yeah. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Lots of fun. Is there any departing words you want our listeners to know about?
Yeah. Never, ever believe that you can't achieve.
Fantastic. It's a lovely place to leave it. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And really great having this conversation.
Thank you.
The Hearing.
Thank you for listening. And if you've got any feedback about the show, we'd love to hear from you. Just contact us at thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.